This is Audible.
John Dies at the End by David Wong. Narrated by Stephen Thorne. Prologue. Solving the following riddle will reveal the awful secret behind the universe, assuming you do not go utterly mad in the attempt. If you already happen to know the awful secret behind the universe, feel free to skip ahead. Let's say you have an axe, just a cheap one from Home Depot. On one bitter winter day, you use said axe to behead a man. Don't worry, the man was already dead. Or maybe you should worry because you're the one who shot him. He had been a big, twitchy guy with veiny skin stretched over swollen biceps, a tattoo of a swastika on his tongue, teeth filed into razor-sharp fangs, you know the type. And you're chopping off his head because even with 8 bullet holes in him, you're pretty sure he's about to spring back to his feet and eat the look of terror right off your face. On the follow-through of the last swing, though, the handle of the axe snaps in a spray of splinters. You now have a broken axe. So after a long night of looking for a place to dump the man and his head, you take a trip into town with your axe. You go to the hardware store, explaining away the dark reddish stains on the broken handle as barbecue sauce. You walk out with a brand new handle for your axe. The repaired axe sits undisturbed in your garage until the spring, when, on one rainy morning, you find in your kitchen a creature that appears to be a foot-long slug with a bulging egg sac on its tail. Its jaws bite one of your forks in half with what seems like very little effort. You grab your trusty axe and chop the thing into several pieces. On the last blow, however, the axe strikes a metal leg of the overturned kitchen table and chips out a notch right in the middle of the blade. Of course, a chipped head means yet another trip to the hardware store. They sell you a brand new head for your axe. As soon as you get home, you meet the reanimated body of the guy you beheaded earlier. He's also got a new head, stitched on with what looks like plastic weed trimmer line, and it's wearing that unique expression of "you're the man who killed me last winter" resentment that one so rarely encounters in everyday life. You brandish your axe. The guy takes a long look at the weapon with his squishy, rotting eyes, and in a gargly voice he screams, "That's the same axe that beheaded me." Is he right? I was pondering that riddle as I reclined on my porch at 3 a.m., a chilled breeze numbing my cheeks and earlobes and flicking tickly hairs across my forehead. I had my feet up on the railing, leaning back in one of those cheap plastic lawn chairs, the kind that blow out onto the lawn during every thunderstorm. It would have been a good occasion to smoke a pipe, had I owned one, and had I been 40 years older. It was one of those rare moments of mental peace I get these days, the kind you don't appreciate until they're my cell phone screeched. The sound like a sonic bee sting. I dug the slim little phone from my jacket pocket, glanced at the number, and felt a sickening little twinge of fear. I disconnected the call without answering. The world was silent again, save for the faint applause of trees rustling in the wind and crumbly dead leaves scraping lightly down the pavement. That, and the scuffle of a mentally challenged dog trying to climb onto the chair next to me. After 2 attempts to mount the thing, Molly managed to send the chair clattering onto its side. She stared at the toppled chair for several seconds and then started barking at it. The phone again. Molly growled at the chair. I closed my eyes, said an angry 5-word prayer, and answered the call. Hello?
Dave, this is John. Your pimp says bring the heroin shipment tonight or he'll be forced to stick you. Meet him where we buried the Korean whore, the one without the goatee.
That was code. It meant, come to my place as soon as you can, it's important. Code, you know, in case the phone was bugged.
John. It's 3 in the... Oh, don't forget, tomorrow's the day we kill the president.
Click. He was gone. That last part was code for stop and pick me up some cigarettes on the way. Actually, the phone probably was bugged, but I was confident that people doing it could just as easily do some kind of remote intercept of our brain waves if they wanted, so it was moot. 2 minutes and one very long sigh later, I was humming through the night in my truck, waiting for the heater to blow warm air and trying not to think of Frank Campo. I clicked on the radio, hoping to keep the fear at bay via distraction. I got a local right-wing talk radio program.
I'm here to tell you, immigration, it's like rats on a ship. America is the ship, and all these rats are coming on board, y'all. And you know what happens when a ship gets too many rats on board? It sinks. That's what.
I wondered if a ship had ever really sunk that way. I wondered what was giving my truck that rotten egg smell. I wondered if the gun was still under the driver's seat. I wondered, was there something moving back there in the darkness?
I glanced in my rearview mirror. No. A trick of the shadows. I thought of Frank Campo. Frank was an attorney, heading home from the office one evening in his black Lexus. The car's wax job gleaming in the night like a shell of black ice, Frank feeling weightless and invincible behind the greenish glow of his dashboard lights. He senses a tingling on his legs. He flips on the dome light. Spiders. Thousands of them, each the size of a hand. They're spilling over his knees, pushing up inside his pant legs. The things look like they're bred for war, jagged black bodies with yellow stripes, long spiny legs like needle points. He freaks, cranks the wheel, flips down an embankment. After they pried him out of the wreckage and after he stopped ranting, the cops assured him there wasn't a sign of even one spider inside the car. If it had ended there, you could write it off as a bad night, a trick of the eyes, one of Scrooge's bad potatoes. But it didn't end there. Frank kept seeing things, awful things, and over the months, all the king's doctors and all the king's pills couldn't make Frank's waking nightmares go away. And yet, other than that, the guy was fine, lucid, as sane as a sunset. He'd write a brilliant legal brief on Wednesday, and on Thursday, he'd swear he saw tentacles writhing under the judge's robes. So, who do you go to in a situation like that? I pulled up to John's building, felt the old dread coming back, churning like a sour stomach. The brisk wind chased me to the door, carrying a faint sulfur smell blown from a plant outside town that brewed drain cleaner. That, and the pair of hills in the distance, gave the impression of living downwind from a sleeping, farty giant. John opened the door to his third-floor apartment and immediately gestured toward a very cute and very frightened-looking woman on his sofa.
"Dave, this is Shelley. She needs our help."
Our help. That dread, like a punch in the stomach. You see, people like Frank Campo and this girl, they never came for our help when they needed a carburetor rebuilt. We had a specialty. Shelley was probably 19, with powder blue eyes and the kind of crystal-clear pale skin that gave her a China doll look, chestnut curls bundled behind her head in a ponytail. She wore a long, flowing skirt that her fingers kept messing with, an outfit that only emphasized how small she was. She had the kind of self-conscious, pleading helplessness some guys go crazy for, girl in distress. Makes you want to rescue her, take her home, curl up with her, tell her everything is going to be okay. She had a white bandage on her temple. John stepped into the corner of his tiny apartment that served as the kitchen and smoothly returned to place a cup of coffee in her hands. I struggled to keep my eyes from rolling. John's almost therapist-like professionalism was ridiculous in a room dominated by a huge plasma screen TV with four video game systems wired to it. John had his hair pulled back into a neat job interview ponytail and was wearing a button-up shirt. He could look like a grown-up from time to time. I was about to warn the girl about John's coffee, which tasted like a cup of battery acid someone had pissed in and then cursed at for several hours, but John turned to her and in a lawyerly voice said, "Shelley, tell us your story." She raised timid eyes to me. "It's my boyfriend. He won't leave me alone. He's been harassing me for about a week. My parents are gone on vacation, and I'm terrified to go home." She shook her head, apparently out of words. She sipped the coffee, then grimaced as if it had bit her. "Miss Morris," she said, barely audible. "Miss Morris, I strongly recommend a woman's shelter. They can help you get a restraining order, keep you safe, whatever. There are three in this city, and I'll be happy to make the call. He's been dead for 2 months. John cast a little gleeful glance my way as if to say, "See how I deliver for you, Dave?" I hated that look. She went on, I didn't know where else to go. I heard, you know, through a friend of mine that you handle, unusual problems." She nudged aside a stack of DVD cases, and on an end table she sat the mug down, glancing at it distrustfully as if to remind herself not to accidentally drink from it again, lest it betray her anew. She turned back to me. "They say you're the best." I didn't inform her that whoever called us the best had pretty low standards. I guess we were the best in town at this, but who would you brag to about that? It's not like this shit has its own section of the phone book. I walked over to a cushioned chair and scooped out its contents, four worn guitar magazines, a sketchpad, and a leather-bound King James version of the Holy Bible. As I tried to settle in, a leg broke off and the whole chair slumped over at a 30-degree angle. I leaned over nonchalantly, trying to look like that's exactly what I had expected to happen. "Okay. When he comes, you can see him?"
"Yes.
I can hear him, too, and he. She brushed the bandage on the side of her skull. I looked at her in bewilderment. Was she serious?
He hits you?
Yes.
With his fist?
Yes.
John looked up from his coffee indignantly.
Man, what a dick.
I did roll my eyes this time and glared at John once they stopped. I don't know if you've ever seen a ghost, but I'm guessing that if you did, the thing didn't run over and punch you in the face. I'm guessing that's never happened to any of your friends, either.
When it first happened, Shelley said, I thought I was going crazy. Up until now, I've never believed
in ghosts, I finished. Right. That line was obligatory, everybody wanting to come off as the credible skeptic. Look, miss, I don't want to...
I told her we could look into it tonight, John said, heading me off before I accidentally introduced some rational thought into this thing.
He's haunting her house, out in town name removed for privacy. I thought you and I could head over there, get out of the city for a night, show this bastard what's what.
I felt a burst of irritation, mostly because John knew the story was bullshit. But then it suddenly clicked in my mind that, yes, John knew. And he had called me because he was trying to set me up with this girl. Button cute, dead boyfriend, chance to be her hero. As usual, I didn't know whether to thank him or punch him in the balls. 16 different objections rose up in my mind at once, and somehow they all canceled each other out. Maybe if there had been an odd number. We headed out in my Bronco. We had told Shelley not to drive herself in case she had a concussion, but the reality was that whether or not her story was true, we still had vivid memories of Mr. Campo and his unusually spidery car. You see, Frank found out the hard way that the dark things lurking in the night don't haunt old houses or abandoned ships. They haunt minds. Shelley was in the passenger seat, hugging herself, looking blankly out the windshield. She said,
So do you guys, like, do this a lot?
Off and on, said John. Been doing it for a few years.
How does somebody get into this?
There was an incident, he said. A series of incidents, I guess. A dead guy, another dead guy, some drugs. It's kind of a long story. Now we can see things. Sometimes. I have a dead cat that follows me around, wondering why I never feed it. Oh, and I had one hamburger that started mooing when I ate it. He glanced at me. You remember that?
I grunted, said nothing.
It wasn't mooing, John. It was screaming.
Shelley didn't look like she was listening anymore.
I call it Dante's syndrome, John said.
I had never heard him call it by any such thing.
Meaning, I think Dave and I gained the ability to peer into hell. Only it turns out hell is right here, and it's through us, and around us, and in us, like the microbes that swarm through your lungs and guts and veins. Hey, look, an owl!
We all looked. It was an owl, all right.
Anyway, I broke in, we just did a couple of favors for people, eventually word got around.
I felt like that was enough background, and I wanted to stop John before he got to the part where he says he kept eating that screaming hamburger down to the last bite. I left the truck running as I jumped out at my place for supplies. I bypassed the house for the weather-worn tool shed in the backyard, opened the padlocked door, and swept over the dark shelves with my flashlight. A Winnie the Pooh toy with dried blood around its eyes. A stuffed and mounted badger conda, a cross between a badger and an anaconda. A large mason jar filled with cloudy formaldehyde where inside floated a 6-inch clump of cockroaches arranged roughly in the shape of a human hand. I grabbed a medieval-style torch John had stolen from the wall of a theme restaurant. I picked up a clear squeeze bottle filled with a thick green liquid that immediately turned blood red as soon as I touched it. I reconsidered, sat it back on the shelf, and grabbed my vintage 1987 ghetto blaster instead. I went into the house and called to Molly. I opened a small plastic tub in the kitchen cabinet filled with little pink rubbery chunks like erasers. I put a handful in my pocket and rushed back out the door, the dog following on my heels. Shelley lived in a simple 2-story farmhouse, black shutters on white siding. It sat on an island of turf in a sea of harvest-flattened cornfields. We walked past a mailbox shaped like a cow and saw a hand-painted sign on the front door that read, The Morrisons, established 1962. John and I had a long debate at the door about whether or not that apostrophe belonged there.
I know. If I had a brain, I would have walked away right then.
John stepped up, pushed open the front door, and ducked aside. I dug in my pocket and pulled out one of the pink chunks. They were steak-shaped dog treats, complete with little brown grill lines. I realized at that moment that no dog would know what those grill lines were, and that they were purely for my benefit. Molly! I shook the treat in front of her and then tossed it through the door. The dog ran in after it. We waited for the sound of, say,
dog flesh splattering across a wall, but heard only the padding of Molly's paws. Eventually she came back to the door, grinning stupidly. We decided it was safe to go in. Shelley opened her mouth as if to express some kind of disapproval, but apparently decided against it. We stepped into the dark living room. Shelley moved to flip on a light, but I stopped her with a hand motion. Instead, John hefted the torch and touched his lighter to it. A foot-tall flame erupted from the head, and we slowly crept through the house by its flickering light. I noticed John had brought along a thermos of his coffee, this favor already qualifying as an all-nighter. I admit the horrific burning sensation really did keep you awake. I asked, "Where do you see him mostly?" Shelley's fingers started twisting at her skirt again.
"The basement. And once I saw him in the bathroom, his hand, came up through the toilet while I..."
"Okay. Show us the basement door."
"It's in the kitchen, but I... Guys, I don't want to go down there."
"It's cool," John said. "Stay here with the dog, and we'll go down and check it out." I glanced at John, figuring that should have been my line as her handsome new nightly protector. We clomped down the stairs, torchlight pooling down the stairwell. Shelley waited behind us, crouching next to Molly and stroking her back. A nice modern basement. Washer and dryer. A hot water heater making a soft ticking sound. One of those waist-deep floor freezers. John said, "He's not here."
"Big surprise." John used the torch to light a cigarette. "She seems like a nice girl, doesn't she?" John said softly, and with a kind of smarmy wink in his voice. "You know, she reminds me of Amber, Jennifer's friend. When she came to my door for a second, I actually thought it was her. By the way, I want to thank you for coming along, Dave, sort of being my wingman on this. I'm not saying I'm going to take advantage of her distress or anything, but..." I had tuned John out. Something was off, I knew right then, lingering in the back of my mind like a kid in the last row of the classroom with his hand up. John was acting all detective-y now, leaning over a large sink with a bundle of white cloth draped over the side. "Oh, yeah," said John, pulling up a length of cloth. "Take a look at this shit." The garment was white, a single piece with straps like an apron. Well, it had been white. Once. Now it was mostly smudges of faded blood pink at the center, like a kindergarten kid's rendering of the Japanese flag. I turned to the large floor freezer. That freaking dread again, cold and hard and heavy. I strode over and opened the lid. Oh, jeez. It was a tongue. That's the first thing I saw, rubbery and purplish and not quite human. It was longer, animal-like, twisted inside a Ziploc bag and coated in frost. And it wasn't alone. The freezer was filled with hunks of flesh, some in clear bags, some bigger chunks in pink-stained white paper. Butcher paper. White apron.
"Well, I think it's obvious," said John. "Those stories of UFOs that go around mutilating cows, I think we just solved it, my friend."
I sighed. "It's a deer, you jackass. Her dad hunts, apparently. They keep the meat." I nudged around and found a frozen turkey, some sausages. I closed the lid to the fridge, feeling stupid, though not for the reason I should have felt stupid. I wasn't thinking. Too late at night, too little sleep. John started poking around in cabinets. I glanced around for the boombox, realizing now that we hadn't brought it down here. Why did that bother me? It was upstairs with Shelley, right?
"Hey, Dave. You remember that guy whose basement got flooded, then called us and swore he had a 15-foot great white shark swimming down there?"
I did remember, but didn't answer, afraid of losing that thread of thought that kept floating just out of reach like a wayward balloon on a windy day. Besides, when we got there, it wasn't a great white at all, just a garden variety 8-foot tiger shark. We told the guy to wait until the basement dried out and call us back. When the water left, so did the shark, as if it evaporated or seeped out the tiny cracks in the concrete.
Think. Damned attention span. Something is wrong here.
I tried to pull myself back from my tangent, thinking of the boombox again. John had found it at a garage sale. There's a story in the Old Testament, a young David driving away an evil spirit by playing pretty music on his harp.
Wait a second.
John, did I hear you say you thought she looked like Amber?
Yeah.
John, Amber's almost as tall as me. Blonde hair, kind of top-heavy, right?
Yeah. Cute as hell, I mean.
And you think Shelley looks like her, the girl sitting upstairs?
Yeah, John turned to face me, already getting it.
John, Shelley is short, short with dark hair, blue eyes. They haunt minds. John sighed, plucked out his cigarette, and flung it to the floor. Fuck!
We turned toward the stairs, took a step up, and froze. Shelley was there, sitting halfway up the stairs, one arm curled around Molly's neck, innocent, wary eyes, playing the part. I stepped slowly onto the third stair, said, "Tell me something, miss. I'm sorry, I've forgotten your last name."
"Shelley is fine."
"Yeah. Remind me anyway, I hate forgetting things."
"Morris."
I took another step toward her. That's what I thought. Another step, I heard John step up behind me. "So," I said, "whose house is this?"
"What?"
"The sign out front says Morrison, Morrison, not Morris. Now, would you describe your own appearance for me?"
"I don't."
"You see, because John and I have this thing where we're both seeing completely different versions of you. Now, John has eyesight problems because of his constant masturbation, but I don't think..." She burst into snakes.
"That's right."
Her body sort of spilled out of itself, falling into a dark, writhing puddle on the ground. It was a tangle of long black serpents rolling over each other and down the steps. We kicked at them as they slithered past, John warding them off with the torch. Some, I saw, had patches of color on their scales, like flesh or the flowered pattern of Shelley's dress. I caught a glimpse of one snake with a writhing human eyeball still embedded in its side, the iris powder blue. Molly jumped back and barked, a little too late, I thought, and made a show of snapping at one of the snakes as it wound its way down the stairs. She bounded to the top of the stairs and disappeared through the doorway. We kicked through the slithering things and stomped up after the dog just as the stairwell door banged shut on its own. I reached for the knob. At the same moment, it began to melt and transform, turning pink and finally taking the shape of a flaccid penis. It flopped softly against the door like a man was cramming it through the knob hole from the other side. I turned back to John and said, "That door cannot be opened." We stumbled back down the stairs, John jumping the last five, shoes smacking on the concrete. The snakes fled from the firelight and disappeared under shelves and between cardboard boxes. That's when the basement started filling with shit. The brown sludge oozed up from the floor drain, an unmistakable stench rising above it. I looked around for a window we could crawl out of, found none. The sewage bloomed out from the center of the floor, swirling around the soles of my shoes. John shouted, "There!" I whipped my head in his direction, saw him grab a little plastic crate from a shelf and set it on the floor. He climbed up on it, then just stood there with the muck rising below. Finally, he looked at me and said, "What are you doing? Go find us a way out of here." I was ankle deep now in a pool that was disturbingly warm. I sloshed around, looking above me until I found the large square duct feeding into the first floor from the furnace, the return air vent. I went to a pegboard on the wall and grabbed a foot-long screwdriver. I jabbed it into the crease between the metal of the duct and the floor, prying down the apparatus with a squeal of pulled nails. I finally got hold of the edge of the metal duct and felt it cut into my fingers. I pulled it down to reveal the dark living room above me, blocked by a metal grid. I jumped and knocked the grate aside with my hands. I leapt again and grabbed floor with both hands, feeling carpet under my fingers. With a series of frantic, awkward movements, I managed to pull my limbs up until I could roll over onto the floor of the living room. I looked back at the square hole and saw a flicker of flame emerge, followed by the torch, and then John's hand. In a few seconds, we were both standing in the living room, glancing around, breathing heavily.
Nothing.
A low, pulsing sound emerged from the air around us. A laugh. A dry, humorless cough of a noise. As if the house itself was expelling the air with giant lungs of wood and plaster. John said, "Asshole." "John, I'm changing my cell number tomorrow, and I'm not giving you the new one. Now let's get this over with." We both knew the drill. We had to draw the thing out somehow. John handed me his lighter. "You light some candles. I'll go stand in the shower, naked." Molly followed me as I went back to where we left the boombox and the other supplies. I lit a few candles around the house, just enough to make it spooky. John showered. I found another bathroom and washed the sludge off my shoes and feet. "Oh, no," I heard John shout over the running water. "It's dark in here, and here I am in the shower, alone. I'm so naked and vulnerable." Out of things to do, I walked around for a bit and eventually found a bedroom. I glanced at my watch, sighed, then lay down over the covers. It was almost 4 in the morning. This could go on for hours, or days. Time. That's all they have. I heard Molly plop down on the floor below. I reached down to pet her,
and she licked my hand the way dogs do. I wondered why in the world they felt the need to do that. I've often thought about trying it the next time somebody got their fingers close to my mouth, like at the dentist. John came back 20 minutes later wearing what must have been the smallest towel he could find. He lowered his voice.
I think I saw a hatch for an attic earlier. I'm going to see if there's room to crawl around up there, see if maybe there's a big, scary-looking footlocker it can pop out of or something.
I nodded. John raised his voice theatrically and said, Oh, no. We're trapped here all alone. I will go see if I can find help. Yes, I answered loudly. Perhaps we should split up. John left the room. I tried to relax, hoping even to doze off. Ghosts love to sneak up on you when you're sleeping. I scratched Molly's head and... sleep. Licking. A soft splashing sound from another room. I dreamed I saw a shadow peel itself off the far wall and float toward me. Most of my dreams are like that, always based on something that really happened. My eyes snapped open, my right arm still hanging over the edge of the mattress, the rough tongue still flapping away at my ring finger. How long had I been out? 30 seconds? 2 hours? I sat up, trying to adjust to the darkness. A faint glow pulsed from the hall where the nearest candle burned away in the bathroom. I quietly stepped off the foot of the bed and headed across the room into the hallway. Down the hall now, toward the sound and the light. I ran my hand along the textured plaster of the wall until I reached the bathroom, the source of the gentle splashing. Not splashing, slurping. I peered in. Molly, drinking from the toilet. She turned to look at me with an almost cat-like, "Can I help you?" stare. I thought absently that she was drinking the poo water with the same mouth she used to lick my hand. If she's in here, then that wasn't her by the bed. I picked the candle off the counter and headed back to the bedroom. I stepped in, the candle casting an uneven halo of light around me, rustling the shadows aside. I moved toward the bed and saw... meat. Dozens of the wrapped and now partially unwrapped hunks from the freezer, laying neatly on the floor next to the bed in an almost ceremonial fashion, the objects arranged in the rough shape of a man. I moved the light toward the head area, where I found a frozen turkey still in the butterball wrapper. Under it, wedged between turkey and torso, was the disembodied deer tongue, flapping around of its own accord. That was different. I jumped back as the turkey, the tongue, and a slab of ribs levitated off the floor. The man-shaped arrangement of meat rose up, as if functioning as one body. It pushed itself up on two arms made of game hens and country bacon, planting two hands with sausage-linked fingers on the floor. The phrase, sodomized by a bratwurst poltergeist, suddenly flew through my mind. Finally, it stood upright, looking like the mascot for a butcher shop whose profits went entirely to support the owner's acid habit. John, we got, something here. It was about 7 feet tall, its turkey head swiveling side to side to survey the room, the tongue swaying uselessly below. It extended a sausage to me.
You.
It was an accusation. Had we dealt with this thing before? I didn't remember it, but I was bad with faces.
You have tormented me 6 times. Now, prepare to meet your doom.
I have no way of knowing that it actually said M-E-A-T instead of M-E-E-T, but I'll give it the benefit of the doubt. I ran.
John! John, we got a situation 53 here.
The thing gave chase, its shaved ham feet slapping the floor behind me. My candle went out. I tossed it aside. I saw a closed door to my right, so I skidded to a stop, threw it open, and flung myself in. Linen shelves smacked me in the face, and I fell back out of the closet, dazed. The meat man wrapped its cold links around my neck and lifted me up. It pinned me against the wall.
You disappoint me. All those times we have dueled. In the desert, in the city, you thought you had vanquished me in Venice, didn't you?
I was so impressed by this thing's ability to articulate words using that flapping deer tongue and a frozen turkey that I almost lost track of what it was saying. Venice? Did he say Venice? What? Molly came by just then, trotting along like everything was just A-okay in Dogland. Then she noticed some meat standing nearby and started happily chewing on a 6-inch-wide tube of bologna serving as the thing's ankle.
Arr!
It dropped me to the floor. I scrambled to my feet and ran downstairs. The meat man followed.
At the foot of the stairs, John was waiting. He was holding the stereo. The monster stopped halfway down the staircase, its eyeless turkey head staring down the device in John's hands, as if recognizing the danger. Oh, how that Old Testament demon must have howled and shrieked at the sight of young David's harp, seeing at work a form of ancient magic that can pierce any darkness. The walking meat horror knew what was coming, that the same power was about to be tapped. John nodded, as if to say, "Checkmate." He pushed the play button. Sound filled the room, a crystal melody that could lift any human heart and turn away any devil. It was "Here I Go Again" by Whitesnake. The monster grabbed the spots on the turkey where its ears would be and fell to its knees. John wielded the stereo before him like a holy talisman, stepping up the stairs, driving the sound closer to the beast. Every inch of its fat marbled skin and gristle writhed in agony.
"Take it," John screamed, suddenly emboldened. "It looks like you should have taken time to beef up your defenses."
The beast grabbed its abdomen, in pain, I thought. Instead, it pried loose a canned ham, and before John could react, hurled it at the stereo, the can whizzing through the air like a Randy Johnson fastball. Direct hit. Sparks and bits of plastic flew. The stereo tumbled out of John's hands and fell heavily to the stairs. Disarmed, John hopped down to the floor as the beast rose to its feet and pursued. It grabbed John by the neck. It snatched at me, but I dodged and grabbed the coffee thermos from the table. I ran back with the thermos, spun off the top, and dashed the contents at the meaty arm that held John. The meatstrosity screamed. The arm smoked and bubbled, then burst into flame. The limb then blackened and peeled off from the socket, falling to the hardwood below. John was free, falling to his knees and gasping for air. The beast howled, collapsing to the floor meatily. With its only remaining arm, it pointed at me.
"You'll never defeat me, Marconi. I have sealed this house with my powers. You cannot escape."
I stopped, put my hands on my hips, and strode up to it.
"Marconi?
As in Dr./Father Albert Marconi? The guy who hosts magical mysteries on the Discovery Channel?" John stepped over and glared at the wounded thing.
"You dumbass. Marconi is 50 years old. He has white hair. Dave and I aren't that old combined. Your nemesis is probably off giving a seminar, standing waist-deep in a pile of his own money."
The thing turned its turkey at me. "Tell you what," I offered. "If I can get you in touch with Marconi so you two can work out your little differences, will you release us?"
"You lie."
"Well, I can't get him down here, but surely a being as superhumanly powerful as you can destroy him at a distance, right? Here." It watched me as I fished out my cell phone and dialed. After talking to a secretary, a press agent, a bodyguard, an operator, the secretary again, and finally a personal assistant, I got through.
"This is Marconi. My secretary says you have some kind of meat monster there?"
"Yeah, hold on." I offered the phone to Meaty. "Do we have a deal?" The thing stood up, hesitated, then finally nodded its turkey up and down. I held out the phone while giving John a dark look that I hope conveyed the fact that Plan B involved me letting the monster beat the shit out of him while I tried to escape out of a window somewhere. Fucking girl and her ghost boyfriend. Marconi would have seen this shit coming a mile away. A bundle of sausage fingers took the phone from my hand.
"So," it boomed into the receiver, "we meet again, Marconi. You thought you had vanquished me, but I..."
The beast spontaneously combusted into a ball of unholy blue light. With a shriek that pierced my ears, it left our world. The lifeless meat slapped to the floor piece by piece, the cell phone clattering next to the pile. Silence.
"Damn. He's good," said John.
I walked over and picked up the cell phone. I put it to my ear to ask the doctor what he had done, but it was the secretary again. I switched it off. The doctor hadn't even hung around long enough to say hello. John made a casual hand-dusting motion.
"Well, that was pretty stupid."
I tried the front door, and it opened easily. Who knows, maybe it had never been sealed. We took time to straighten up the place, not finding any Morrisons restrained or dismembered, and figuring that Shelley was at least telling the truth when she said the real family was on vacation. The shit had vanished from the basement, but I couldn't fix the heating duct I had messed up earlier. We packed the meat back into the freezer as best we could, with one exception. The sun was already dissolving the night sky by the time I got home.
I opened up the tool shed and set the broken boombox inside. I found an empty jar, filled it from a square can of formaldehyde, and dropped the deer tongue in. I placed it on the shelf next to a stuffed monkey paw, lying lifeless with two fingers extended. I locked up and went to bed. From the Journal of David Wong.
Book 1. They China Food.
Chapter 1. The Levitating Jamaican. They say Los Angeles is like the Wizard of Oz. One minute it's small-town monochrome neighborhoods, and then boom, all of a sudden you're in a sprawling technicolor freak show, dense with midgets. Unfortunately, this story does not take place in Los Angeles. The place I was sitting was a small city in the Midwest which will remain undisclosed for reasons that will become obvious later. I was at a restaurant called They China Food, which was owned by a couple of brothers from the Czech Republic who, as far as I could tell, didn't know a whole lot about China or food. I had picked the place thinking it was still the Mexican Bar and Grill it had been the previous month. In fact, the change was so recent that one wall was still covered by an incompetent mural of a dusky woman riding a bull and proudly flying the flag of Mexico, carrying a cartoon burrito the size of a pig under her arm. This is a small city, large enough to have four McDonald's, but not so big that you can see more than the occasional homeless person on the way. You can get a taxi here, but they're not out roving around where you can jump off the sidewalk and hail one. You have to call them on the phone, and they're not yellow. The weather varies explosively from day to day in this part of America, the jet stream undulating over us like an angry snake god. I've seen a day when the temperature hit 108 degrees, another when it dipped 18 degrees below zero, another day when the temperature swung 43 degrees in 8 hours. We're also in Tornado Alley, so every spring, swirling, howling charcoal demons materialize out of the air and shred mobile homes as if they were dropped in huge blenders. But all that aside, it's not a bad town. Not really. A lot of unemployment, though. We've got 2 closed factories and a rotting shopping mall that went bankrupt before it ever opened. We're not far from Kentucky, which marks the unofficial border to the south, so one sees more than enough pickup trucks decorated with stickers of Confederate flags and slogans proclaiming their brand of truck is superior to all others. Lots of country music stations, lots of jokes that contain the word nigger, a sewer system that occasionally backs up into the streets for some unknown reason, lots and lots of stray dogs around, many with grotesque deformities. Okay, it's a shithole. There are a lot of things about this undisclosed city that the Chamber of Commerce won't tell you, like the fact that we have more than quadruple the rate of mental illness per capita than any other city in the state, or that in the 80s, the EPA did a very discreet study of the town's water supply in hope of finding a cause. The chief inspector on that case was found dead inside one of the water towers a week later, which was considered strange, since the largest opening into the tank was a valve just 10 inches wide. It was also considered strange that both of his eyes were fused shut, but that's another story. My name is David, by the way. Hi. I once saw a man's kidney grow tentacles, tear itself out of a ragged hole in his back, and go slapping across my kitchen floor. I sighed and stared blankly out of the window of They China Food, occasionally glancing at the clock sign that flashed 6:32 p.m. in the darkness from the credit union across the street. The reporter was late. I thought about leaving. I didn't want to tell this story. The story of me and John, and what's happening in Undisclosed, and everywhere else, I guess. I can't tell the story without sounding as nuts as a nut bush, or whatever nuts grow from. I pictured myself pouring my heart out to this guy, ranting about the shadows, and the worms, and Korok, and Fred Durst, babbling away under this wall-sized portrait of a badly drawn burrito. How was this going to turn into anything but a ridiculous clusterfuck? Enough. I said to myself, just go. When you're on your deathbed, you're going to wish you could get back all the time you spent waiting for other people. I started to stand, but stopped myself halfway up. My stomach flinched, as if cattle prodded. I felt another dizzy spell coming on. I fell hard back into the booth. More side effects. I was already lightheaded, my body trembling from shoes to shoulders in random spells, like I swallowed a vibrator. It's always like this when I'm on the sauce. I dosed 6 hours ago. I took slow, deep breaths, trying to cycle down, to level off, to chill out. I turned to watch a little Asian waitress deliver a plate of chicken fried rice to a bearded guy on the other side of the room. I squinted. In half a second, I counted 5,829 grains of rice on her plate. The rice was grown in Arkansas. The guy who ran the harvester was nicknamed Cooter. I'm not a genius, as my dad and all my old teachers at undisclosed Eastern High School will inform you without even the slightest provocation. I'm not psychic either. Just side effects, that's all. The shakes again. A quick fluttery wave, like the adrenaline rush you get when you lean your chair too far past the tipping point. Might as well wait it out, I guess. I was still waiting on my flaming shrimp reunion, a dish I ordered just to see what it looked like. I wasn't hungry. A flatware set was wrapped in a napkin on the table in front of me. A few inches away was my glass of iced tea. A few inches from that was another object, one I didn't feel like thinking about right then. I unwrapped my utensils. I closed my eyes and touched the fork, immediately knew it was manufactured in Pennsylvania 6 years ago, on a Thursday, and that a guy had once used it to scrape a piece of dog shit from his shoe. "You've just got to make it through a couple of days of this," said my own voice again from inside my skull. "You'll open your eyes tomorrow or the next day, and everything will be okay again. Well, mostly okay. You'll still be ugly and kind of stupid, and you'll occasionally see things that make you..." I did open my eyes, and jerked in shock. A man was sitting across from me in the booth. I hadn't heard or felt or smelled him when he slid into the seat. Was this the reporter I spoke to on the phone? Or a ninja? "Hey," I mumbled, "are you Arnie?"
"Yeah. Did you doze off there?"
He shook my hand.
No, I was just trying to rub something on the back of my eyelid.
"I'm David Wong. Good to meet you."
"Sorry I'm late."
Arnie Blondstone looked just like I imagined him. He was older, uneven haircut and a bad mustache, a wide face made for a cigar. He wore a gray suit that looked older than I was, a tie with a fat Windsor knot. He had told me he was a reporter for a national magazine and wanted to do a feature on me and my friend John. It wasn't the first request like this, but it was the first one I had agreed to. I looked the guy up on the web, found out he did quirky little human interest bits, Charles Kuralt stuff. One article about a guy who obsessively collects old light bulbs and paints landscapes on them. Another about a lady with 600 cats, that sort of thing. It's what polite people have instead of freak shows, I guess. Stories we can laugh at around the coffee machines in the office break room. Arnie's gaze stayed on my face a little too long, taking in my beads of cold sweat, my pale skin, the thatch of overgrown hair. Instead of pointing out any of that, Arnie said,
"You don't look Asian, Mr. Wong."
"I'm not. I was born in..." Undisclosed. I had the name changed, thought it would make me harder to find. Arnie gave me the first of what I assumed would be many, many skeptical looks.
"How so?"
I half-closed my eyes, my mind flooding with images of the 103 billion humans who have been born since this species appeared. A sea of living people, dying and multiplying like cells in a single organism. I squeezed my eyes shut, trying to clear my mind by focusing on a mental image of the waitress's boobs. I said, "Wong is the most common surname in the world. You try to Google it, you got a shitload of results to sift through before you get to me." He said,
"Okay. Your family live around here?"
Getting right to it, then. "I was adopted. Never knew my real dad. You could be my dad for all I know. Are you my dad?"
I don't think so."
I tried to figure out if these were warm-up questions to prime the interview pump or if he already knew. I suspected the latter. Might as well go all in. That's why we're here, right? "My adopted family moved away. I won't tell you where they are. But get out your pen because you'll want to write this down. My biological mom? She was institutionalized."
"That must have been hard. What was the..."
"She was a strung-out, crack-addicted cannibal, dabbled in vampirism and shamanism. My mom, she worshipped some major devil when I was a toddler. Blew her welfare check every month on black candles. Sure, Satan would do her favors now and then, but there's always a catch with the devil. Always a catch." A pause from Arnie, then,
"Is that true?"
"No. This silliness is what I do when I'm nervous. She was bipolar, that's all. Couldn't keep a house. Isn't the other story better, though? You should use it." Arnie gave me a practiced look of reporterly sincerity and said,
"I thought you wanted to get the truth out, your side of it. If not, then why are we even here, Mr. Wong?"
"Because I let women talk me into things." "You're right. Sorry. Now, Since we broached the subject, you spent your senior year in high school in an alternative program.
Yeah, that was just a misunderstanding, I lied. They have this label, emotionally disturbed, that they put on you, but it was just a couple of fights. Kids stuff, no charges or anything. Craziness is not hereditary. Arnie eyed me, both of us aware of the fact that juvenile records are sealed from public viewing, and that he would have to take my word for it. I wondered how this would end up in his article, especially in light of the utter batshit insanity of the story I was about to share. He moved his gaze to the other object on the table. From his perspective, a small, innocent-looking container. It was about the size and shape of a spool of thread made of flat-brushed metal. I rested my fingers on it. The surface was icy to the touch, like it had spent all night in the freezer. If you set the thing out in the hot sun from morning to night, it would still feel that way. You could mistake it for a stylish pill bottle, I suppose. I could blow your world away, Arnie. If I showed you what was in this container, you'd never sleep another full night, never really lose yourself in a movie again, never feel at one with the human race until the day you die. But we're not ready for that, not yet. And you sure as hell won't be ready for what's in my truck.
Well, Arnie began again, either way, mental illness is nothing to be ashamed of. We just get sick from time to time, part of being human, you know? For instance, I was just talking to a guy up north, the high-priced lawyer type who spent 2 weeks in the psych ward himself a little while ago. Name of Frank Campo. You know that name?
Yeah, I knew him a little.
Frank wouldn't talk to me, but his family said he was having hallucinations. Almost daily, right? Guy had this car wreck, and from then on he just got worse and worse. He freaked out at Thanksgiving. Wife brought in the turkey, but to Frank, it wasn't a turkey. Frank saw a human baby curled up on the platter, cooked to a golden brown, stuffing jammed in its mouth. He went nuts, wouldn't eat for weeks after that. He got to where he was having incidents every few days. They figured it was brain damage, you know, from the accident, but the doctors couldn't do squat. Right?
Yeah, that's about it.
You skipped the weirdest part, Arnie. What caused the accident in the first place, and what he saw in his car.
And now, said Arnie, he's cured.
Is that what they say? Good for him, then. Good for Frank. And they swear that it was you and your friend who cured him.
Me and John, yeah, we did what we could, but good for Frank. I'm glad to hear he's okay.
A little smile played at Arnie's lips. Acidic. Look at the crazy man with his incompetent crazy man haircut and his crazy little pill bottle and his crazy fucking story. How many decades of cynicism did it take to forge that smirk, Arnie? It makes me tired just looking at it.
Tell me about John.
Like what? In his mid-20s? We went to school together. John isn't his real name either.
Let me guess.
The images started to rush in again, the mass of humanity spreading across the globe over centuries like a time-lapse video of mold taking over an orange. Think of the boobs, 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 boobs. John is the most common first name in the world.
That's right, I said.
And yet there's not a single person named John Wong. I looked it up.
You know, I work with a John Wong.
Oh, really?
Let's move on, Arnie said.
Probably making a mental note that this David Wong guy isn't above just making shit up.
Holy crap, Arnie, just wait till you hear the rest of the story. If your bullshit meter is that finely tuned, in a few minutes it's liable to explode and take half a city block with it.
You guys already got a little bit of a following, don't you? He said, flipping back to a page in a little notebook already riddled with scribbles. I found a couple of discussion boards on the web devoted to you and your friend, your hobby, I guess. So you're what, sort of spiritualists? Exorcists? Something like that?
Okay, enough farting around.
You have 83 cents in your front pocket, Arnie, I said quickly. 3/4, a nickel, 3 pennies. The 3 pennies are dated 1983, 1993, and 1999. Arnie grinned the superior grin of the I'm the smartest man in the room skeptic, then scooped his coins out of his pocket. He examined the contents, confirmed I was right. He coughed out a laugh and brought his fist down on the table, my utensils clinking with the impact.
Well, I'll be damned, that's a neat trick, Mr. Wong.
If you flip the nickel 10 times, I continued, you'll get heads, heads, tails, heads, tails, tails, heads, tails, heads,
Tails.
Tails.
I'm not sure I want to take the time to...
For a brief moment, I considered taking it easy on Arnie. Then I remembered the grin. I unloaded. Last night you had a dream, Arnie. You were being chased through a forest by your mother. She was lashing you with a whip made of knotted penises. Arnie's face fell like an imploding building. As much as I hated the expression on his face a few minutes ago, I love this one. That's right, Arnie. Everything you know is wrong.
You got my attention, Mr. Wong. Oh, it gets better. A lot better.
Bullshit. What it gets is worse. A lot worse.
It started a few years ago, I began. We were just a couple of years out of high school, just kids. So that friend of mine, John, he was at a party. John had a band back in those days. The party was happening Woodstock style in a muddy field next to a lake in a town a few minutes outside of undisclosed city limits. It was April of that year, and the party was being put on by some guy for his birthday or whatever, I don't remember. John and I were there with his band, Three Arms Sally. It was around 9 o'clock when I strode out onto the stage with a guitar slung over my shoulder, greeted by a smattering of unenthusiastic applause from the 100 or so guests. The stage was just a grid of wooden pallets laid together on the grass, orange drop cords snaking underfoot from the amps to a nearby shed. I glanced around, saw a set list taped to one of their crackly old PV amplifiers. It read, Camel Holocaust, Gay Superman, Stairway to Heaven, Love My Sasquatch, 30 Reasons Why I Dislike Chad Wellsberg, Love Me Tender. We took our places. It was me, Head, the drummer, Wally Brown, bass, Kelly Smallwood, bass, and Munch Lombard, bass. John was lead guitar and vocals, but he wasn't on stage, not yet. I should tell you that I had no idea how to play the guitar or any other musical instrument, and that the sound of my singing voice could probably draw blood from a man's ears, and perhaps kill a dog outright. I stepped up to the mic. I want to thank you all for coming. This is my band, Three Arms Sally, and we're here to rock you like the proverbial hurricane. The crowd muttered its indifference. Head hammered the drums for the intro to Camel Holocaust. I slung the guitar around and got ready to rock. Suddenly, my whole body wrenched in a display of unbearable pain, knees buckling. My hands shot to my head and I collapsed to the stage, screaming like a wounded animal. I scraped the guitar strings to throw out some painful spastic feedback on my way down. The crowd gasped, watching as I flew into a series of exaggerated convulsions, then finally lay still. Munch rushed over, studied me like a paramedic. I lay there like a dead man. He touched my neck, then stood and turned to the mic. He's dead, ladies and gentlemen. A rustling, drunken panic in the crowd. Wait, please, please, everyone, pay attention, just calm down. He waited for quiet. Now, he said, we have a whole show to do. Is there anyone here who knows how to sing and play guitar? A tall man stepped out of the crowd. A head of curly long hair like a deflated afro. This was John. He wore an orange t-shirt with a black stenciled stamp bearing the logo of Vista Pines Facility for the Criminally Insane. The last two words had been crossed out with a black magic marker, and the words Not Insane were scrawled crazily over it. The whole shirt, logo and all, was John's handiwork. Well, said John in a fake southern accent, I reckon I can play a little. Kelly, according to the script, invited him onto the stage. John pried the guitar out of my dead hands, while Head and Wally dragged me carelessly off into the grass. John picked up the instrument and tore into the Camel Holocaust intro. Three Arms Sally began every single show this way. I knew a man. No, I made that part up. Hair, hair, hair. Camel Holocaust, Camel Holocaust. That whole bit was something John had come up with. The man having a terrible habit of carrying out his drunken 3 a.m. ideas even after daylight and sobriety came. It was always 3 a.m. for John. I turned onto my back and stared into the night sky. That's what I remember from that last moment of real peace in my life. The rain had ended hours ago, the stars freshly cleaned and polished against their black velvet background. The music thrummed through the ground and the cool moisture of the grass soaked up through my sweatshirt as I gazed into the twinkling jewels of infinity, all spit-shined by God's shirt sleeve. And then the dog barked and everything turned to goat shit. It was rusty red, maybe an Irish setter
or a red Labrador, or a Scottish rust dog. I don't know my dogs. 10 feet of thin chain trailed off its collar. Bounding around the partygoers, a bundle of manic canine energy, drunk on the first freedom of its life. It squatted and peed on the grass, ran over to another spot and peed there, too, marking this whole new world as its territory. It came toward me at a trot, the chain hissing through the grass behind it. It sniffed around my shoes, decided I was dead, I guess, and began snuffling around my pockets to see if I had died with any beef jerky on me. It recoiled when I reached up to pet it, a catty "don't touch the hair" look on its face, a brass tag on its collar, etched with a message. "I'm Molly. Please return me to," with an address in undisclosed listed below, at least 7 miles from home. I wondered how long it had taken the animal to etch that tag. The dog, having nothing else to gain from our relationship, trotted away. I followed it, deciding on the spot that I would load up the dog and return it to the owners, who were probably worried sick about it. Probably a family with a little girl crying her eyes out waiting for it to come back. Or a couple of sorority girls dealing with their grief through a series of erotic massages. It's hard to look cool chasing after a dog, especially since I sort of run like a girl anyway. The dog pitched annoyed glances back my way as I trotted after it, picking up speed each time. I wound up taking a circuitous path all the way to the other side of the field, where I heard something that turned my guts cold. A shriek. High-pitched, almost a whistle. Only 2 creatures on God's earth can make that sound. African gray parrots and 15-year-old female humans. I spun around, moved toward the commotion. The dog seemed to eye me carefully, then ran off in the other direction. I looked around. Ah, giggling now. There was a bundle of girls away from the stage, huddled with their backs to the band. They were surrounding a black guy with dreadlocks, an overcoat. He had one of those Rastafarian berets on his head, definitely going for a look, wanting the attention. 2 of the girls had their hands over their mouths, eyes bulging, screaming for the guy to do it again, do it again. From the reaction, I figured I had just encountered the most dreaded of all partygoers, the amateur magician.
"Oh my God," said the nearest girl. "That guy just levitated."
One girl looked pale, on the verge of tears. Another threw up her hands and walked away, head shaking. Gullibility is a knife at the throat of civilization. "How high?" I asked blandly. The Jamaican turned his gaze on me, trying to pull off the piercing stare of the exotic voodoo priest. It was an expression that was supposed to make me hear theremin music in my head. "You gotta love the skeptic, man," the guy said in a rubber accent that was part Jamaican, part Irish, and part pirate.
"Show him! Show him!" screeched a couple of the girls.
I'm not sure why I feel the need to rein on this kind of parade. I like to think I'm standing up for skepticism, but in reality, I was probably just pissed that this guy was going to have sex tonight, and I wasn't. "What, about 6 inches above the grass, right?" I asked him. "Balducci levitation, made famous by magic hack David Blaine and his television special? All you need is some strong ankles and a little acting, right? And a stupid drunken audience." His gaze froze on me. I had a familiar nervous sensation, one that goes all the way back to elementary school. It's the simultaneous realization that I may have talked my way into another fist fight, and that I had not spent any time learning to fight since the last one. In a town where Friday night bar brawls make the undisclosed emergency room look like the aftermath of a third world election, sometimes it's better for smartasses like me to just keep walking. Then he broke out in a big, white, toothy smile. A charm.
"Let's see. What can I do to impress Mr. Skeptic Mon?" "Ah, looky there. You didn't wash behind your ears, did ya?"
I let out a loud, theatrical sigh as he reached out to the side of my head, presumably to pull out a shiny quarter from behind my ear. But when he pulled back his hand, he was holding not a coin, but a long, wriggling black centipede. He let it dangle over his fist, turning his hand over as it crawled around and around. One of the girls squealed. He pinched it between thumb and forefinger, held the wriggling thing up for everyone to see. I noticed for the first time he had a few layers of first aid tape wrapped around his other hand. He passed this hand in front of the bug, and in a blink, the centipede was gone. The girls gasped. "Well, the bug was a nice touch," I said, glancing at my watch.
You want to know where it went, Mon?
No. I wasn't feeling well, all of a sudden. This guy was giving me an odd feeling in my gut.